Hi, I'm Mindy with Mindy Abair and the Bone Shakers.
The Bone Shakers.
And you're listening to Midwest Beat with Tom Lounges on 89.1 on the Lakeshore.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Tom Lounges. It's time for Midwest Beat here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM and streaming worldwide at lakeshorepublicradio.org. Normally, this show is all about music and the people who make it, but we also cover different branches of the arts. We've had film actors and film directors. We've had TV stars. We've had book authors. We've had poets. We've had magicians. Tonight, it's the book Lost Hammond, Indiana by Joseph S. Peet. He's an author. He's also a colleague of mine at the Times Daily newspaper, and he has written a book about exploring the lost history of Hammond, Indiana on Arcadia Books. And in just a few minutes, we'll get Joseph on the phone with us. And we're going to play some songs, so don't think we're not going to play some good rock and roll, even a little jazz and some other stuff in here, tied to what he talks about in the book. Well, Joseph S. Peet explores all these different aspects of Hammond, the historical aspects, the figures that were part of it, the landmarks that are still here, and of course the landmarks that are gone, like Phil Schmitz and my very own Woodmar Mall, where I used to work. Well, we're going to talk to Joseph about that, and we're going to play some music. Back in the late 70s, early 80s, I spent an awful lot of time in the early years of my music journalism career hanging out, emceeing, and covering these great concerts that they had at a place called the Hammond Civic Center. So these guys came every summer, it seemed, to the Hammond Civic Center during my night rock days, and I always loved them, and I still do, and I hope you will too. I'm talking about the Great UFO. They're a British heavy metal band, and this goes back to their 1979 album, Strangers in the Night, Lights Out, Indiana. Yeah, Lights Out Chicago. Strangers in the Night, UFO, off the classic Strangers in the Night album. And the reason I played that is I mentioned in the beginning, one of my hangouts, if you will, during the late 70s, very early 80s, when I was starting out my career in rock and roll and I was doing music journalism and interviews and emceeing and all that fun stuff that I do, I was hanging at the Hammond Civic Center. Hammond Civic Center had a who's who of everyone that played there. You could almost name any band, and at some point they probably played there. Styx used to rehearse there. I saw Robin Trower, Frank Marino, Wishbone Ash, Rush played there, Ted Nugent, and all the great local bands that were signing record deals back then, like the Hounds and Off-Broadway and the Boys from Illinois and all those great bands. They used to play at the Civic Center, and we were all there, my friends and I, from the high school years to the night rock radio days when I was first starting in underground radio and working at Hegwisch Records. We all hung out there, and the first time I ever emceed a show, ever, was on the stage at the Hammond Civic Center. Of course, that was hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of shows later. I'm here talking about it now. And I believe the first band I ever introduced was the Hounds, a band out of South Holland, Illinois. And we're going to get to something from them, hopefully by the end of the show here. But the reason I played that and the reason I'm talking about the Hammond Civic Center is tonight's topic is Hammond. In fact, it's Lost Hammond. The Hammond of my day, the Hammond of my parents' day, the Hammond of the grandparents' day, and beyond. Of course, there's still a lot going on in Hammond. We're going to touch on that too. There's a great new book out by Joseph S. Pete called Lost Hammond, Indiana. Joseph is a longtime journalist, and he has turned book author. He is a colleague of mine over at the Times newspaper, and he is also featured here often at Lakeshore Public Radio. So let's bring him on right now. Joseph, are you with us?
Oh, yes. I'm very happy to be here, Tom. Big fan of your work. I grew up reading Midwest Beat magazine, and I just was a huge fan of it for years.
Thank you for that. I didn't expect that. Most people don't even remember it anymore. I mean, we did.
Oh, it's a great publication. Anytime I went to a record store when I was a kid, I always made sure to grab a copy, and it was just, I cut my teeth on it, kind of.
Excellent, excellent. Now, how long have you been writing? Let's start with you first, and we're going to talk about the book and how you came to that. But when did you start writing professionally? When did the bug bite, first of all? When did you get your first paycheck? Do you remember?
Oh, well, I've been writing since I was a kid, I guess. I mean, I was always really bookish as a kid, and I just, I'd always hang out at various, region libraries, and I was constantly reading, and it just turned into just desire to write. And I started, when I went down to Indiana University, I was in the student newspaper, the Indiana Daily Student, and I started practicing journalism there, and I did, freelancing for the Indianapolis Star, covering, Martinsville, city government and Morgan County, and just went on to become, journalist. I've always kind of wanted to write novels, so that's kind of been my long-term goals. But, mm-hmm. Outside of a few people like Stephen King, that doesn't really pay the bills. So you got to have a day job, and it just lets me practice my craft and cut my chops. And
that's true. I mean, I'm a history major myself, and you definitely, I love the way you wrote this. I love the fact that you kind of cover a wide swath of history in Hammond. You do the pop culture, but you do the business, you do the politics, you do a little of everything. And surprisingly, it's for a city and the wealth of time that you cover in these pages, it's about 200 pages. So it's not very thick. I mean, it's a quick, easy read, but you cover a lot of ground. How long did it take you to actually get this book from start to fruition?
Oh, well, it is part of a series. I literally wrote it as long as they would let me. They cap it off at 50,000 words. I ended up having to cut a few thousand words at the end. But it took about a year. They had approached about doing it, and I was born in Hammond. I grew up outside the city. I spent a lot of time there. I also went to the Civic Center. I remember fondly as a kid going to boxing matches there with my dad and going to the circus. I won a calculator and a raffle there when the circus was in town. Used to go to Woodmar a lot and the bookstore in there.
Mm-hmm.
And, frequent in the town. I grew up mostly in Highland, just outside of Hammond, but spent a lot of time there. And just, I've always wanted to write a book or books about the region, because I've always felt this area is underappreciated. We built the skyscrapers in Chicago, the Houston Astrodome, our steel, touchdown Jesus at Notre Dame, the St. Louis Arch. We built all these landmarks in the 20th century. This was where ecology was invented. This was, Octave Chanute helped invent flight, but I feel our area doesn't always get the credit and often gets, overlooked. And I've just always wanted to kind of write about Northwest Indiana and kind of celebrate it in books. You know, it took about a year. I spent a lot of research at the Hammond Public Library, at the local history, the Suzanne G. Long local history room, and then at the Calumet Regional Archives, and then in Indiana University of Northwest in Gary, and then also just, you know, reviewing, you know, old newspaper articles from, of course, the Times and the Post Tribune, but also pretty widely from, you know, the Chicago Tribune, newspapers in Boston, and, you know, wherever the, you know, the story took it.
So you grew up in Hammond or you grew up in Highland?
Oh, no, I grew up in Highland.
Okay. So we kind of have a parallel career, I guess you'd say, because I live in Highland, but I was born in Hammond. I lived on Marshall Avenue in Hessville, where I was born. So the first year of my life was spent there just off the highway when they were building the highway in the 1950s. My dad was sandbagging because of the floods and stuff they had there. And we moved to Highland, and I lived in Hammond again on Cleveland Street over by Freddy's Steakhouse a number of years ago. I moved back when I was raising my daughter. And I used to hang out at Freddy's all the time, go to the Kennedy Theater, the Rockin' Chair Theater, which, of course, you cover in this book. That was a landmark of my youth. And I remember seeing you cover Kiss and all the different shows they did at the Parthenon, the Paramount, and things like that. And one of the first concerts I ever went to was Kiss and Rush. And I think we paid $350 or something like that. It was some ridiculous amount to see these great bands cut their teeth. I think it was Kiss's second album, and I think Rush's first album at the time, but I think eighth grade freshman year, something like that. Time slips away when you get to be a little older, but I do remember those moments, and reading this book really brought a lot of that back to life. It really did. This is an amazing book. You said this is a series. So when you say they limited you and they cut, are you talking about the History Press folks, the publisher?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it's part of a series. It's the Lost series. It's Jerry Davidge with the Post Tribune also wrote one on Gary called Lost Gary. And they've done about 90 of them around the country at different places. And that's why it's kind of formatted the way it is. It's supposed to be about like bygone institutions. I tried to stretch that as much as possible so I could write about current stuff. But that's because originally I was going to do an entire chapter about the Civic Center, but of course it's still there, and it's still, you know, some of the programming they don't have anymore, but like it's still active.
Right.
They still occasionally do, you don't have as many concerts, but they do, you know, occasionally the boxing and the circus, and they do 209 Day there and things. So it didn't really fit with the general like concept of the book. So it ended. I mean, I do reference it, but I was going to do something kind of more in depth about it because obviously it's a big institution in the city. But I remember Freddy's too, because I was that's where my dad used to take us when we got like good grades back into to celebrate or whatever. I remember if the report card was decent, we would go there, and then
we would do that, but it would be at Dog and Suds on I think it was in Kennedy Avenue in Hessville, right across the expressway. There was Dog and Suds. And I remember going there and getting the root beer mugs and an ice cream float, a root beer float on Sundays if I behaved in church. I remember that was a ritual because I was a squirmer, you know. So, but this is just so amazing. When you went to Woodmar, what year was that, or what years was that when you used to go shopping at Woodmar Mall?
Oh, it was in the 90s, I guess, mainly.
Did you come see me at the record store?
I might have. I don't recall.
That was the era when I was co-manager and doing import buying and stuff for the Woodmar Mall record store, right after the renovation. If you remember, they made the mall get contemporary. We were next to Jimmy's Shoes in Court of the Lions, all that fun stuff.
I probably did. I remember the bookstore kind of, and the arcade kind of most vividly.
Mm-hmm.
And the food court. I remember the Woodmar neon script and everywhere. But I would occasionally like walk there and like buy books and stuff. Because I went to S&J Stereo a lot. That's where I used to grab the Midwest Beat.
Okay. In Highland. Store. You know, S&J had its roots in Hammond.
Oh, did it originally?
Yeah.
Okay. I know they moved around a bunch of times. I didn't.
Yeah, no, S&J, we had a store, and I worked at Hagwish Records, and we had I guess you call it an outlet store today. I don't know what we called it then. It was called Hammond Record and Tape Exchange, and it was kind of the used record thing when used records were just starting. Hagwish didn't sell used records, but we did have them over there at Hammond Record and Tape Exchange, and we were just down the street from Wayne's Trick Shop. and S&J Stereo. S&J has been around a long, long time. And S&J actually, like Hegwisch did at the Civic Center, S&J used to sponsor a lot of great concerts. So it was the record stores. They kind of put the music in motion for a lot of the area here. And you could do a whole book on just Holman Avenue in the heyday, back in the day.
Oh, absolutely.
And I remember going to the Times. I don't know how long you've been writing for them, but I go back to the Fayette Street address before we had computers, and we would type on an electric typewriter, and then we'd run the copy over to Hammond on Fayette Street and literally run up this huge staircase to the top floor and give it to a copy editor, and then the next thing you'd know, they would take it, and soon you'd see your name in print. It was a pretty magical time. It was just like the old newspaper movies. That's how we did it.
Oh, that's very cool. Yeah, I've heard stories about it. Like, there was smoking back then.
Oh,
yeah. But I've unfortunately only been there in the time after which it moved to Munster.
Okay.
But I do cover a little bit of that in the book. And then, but I was trying to, you know, have to be elastic to kind of stretch to fit it in. But I wrote about that in WJOB and some of the other media institutions. And unfortunately, one of my favorite photos I came across doing research did not make its way into the book. It was I remember at Woodmar, too, I went to, that's where, like, my mom took me to go to see Santa or whatever back in the, you know, back as a kid. But then I found when it first opened, they would fly Santa in on a helicopter, I guess. And there was a great photo of him being interviewed by a WJOB reporter with, like, a microphone. Like, it was a microphone, like, where it was attached to the briefcase, like the old-fashioned kind of style.
Oh, yeah.
And he's interviewing Santa and, like, the mayor in front of, like, a rotary helicopter. And it was just absolutely beautiful shot, but it unfortunately didn't make its way in because it was too low resolution. It wouldn't have it wasn't big enough to include in like a book. But it was. I just wish that would. I would have liked to have seen that on the cover.
Yeah, that would have been great. I had heard that they flew Santa in. That was even before my time. But I had heard that they used to land Santa in the parking lot. And you know, we used to all hang out in front of Carson's. Of course, they had Ticketmaster back when that first started, and there'd be lines there to get your tickets. You'd camp out all night. So the old days are great. And you cover a lot of stuff way before my time. One of the things I didn't know about that you cover well in here was Madura's Danceland at the Five Points. And I was unaware of that. I had not even heard about it. So what did you find out about that? I mean, that for those that are listening, I guess that would be akin to the Trinidad or the Aragon Ballroom. It was the ballroom dancing scene, the orchestras. Midway Ballroom in Cedar Lake was there. And I would imagine some of the bands that would tour to Midway Ballroom would then come to Hammond. Jimmy Dorsey, Vaughn Monroe, you know, people like that. Les Brown and Gene Krupa, of course, local legend here. What did you find out about Madura's? And were you surprised to find out about that, or were you aware of it?
Oh, no, I was surprised. I was kind of familiar with some of the history of Five Points, like Sol Smith and obviously all that, like the, you know, that. But it used to be like just like a major attraction back in the day. It wasn't just like Madura's, but that's where they had all the Perch Palaces. They had different, you know, different various attractions. It was kind of like the go-to, more than downtown even for a while. It was kind of the go-to place in town. And then but there was a just kind of legendary, you know, dance hall there. It was like, you know, big band orchestras, dance marathons that went on in the early part of the 20th century. And I was pretty surprised to learn about it, but it was quite a few people, couples apparently met there, and it resulted in a lot of people getting married ultimately. But it was you know, it had a huge dome roof and marquee lights, and it could host like 3,000 people at a time.
Wow.
And it was like a very trendy spot to be. They had a lot of big orchestra leaders like Jimmy Dorsey and Gene Krupa and Guy Lombardo, and you know, over the years. And it was I think I had seen because it's immortalized in like one of those South Shore Line posters, and I had seen that, but I wasn't too familiar with like the story kind of behind it. But it was just a lot of that history was lost. One of my favorites about the 5 Point Inn 2-1 was that they tried to do a water park by Wolf Lake, and then they were, you know, they had various, like, they put in like a roller coaster and various water park attractions, but there were so many mosquitoes there that it was driving away the customers. So the entrepreneur who was behind it settled upon the idea of going over to the Whiting Refinery and buying like a gallon of oil and then using and pouring it just directly into the lake to try to kill off the mosquitoes.
Oh, geez.
And it was just kind of a different era.
I'd say so. You'd have the environmentalists out there protesting. Let's play a song from that era. You mentioned Gene Krupa, and he's one of my favorites. And, of course, he's born and raised in Chicago. He's buried right here down the street in Calumet City at Holy Cross Cemetery. He's one of the true legends of the big band era. So let's play a short piece from him and take you back to that dance hall days. This is Ball of Fire, Gene Krupa, big band, and we'll be back to talk some more with Joseph Pete. Taking y'all back to the days of Madura's Danceland in Hammond at the Five Points. That was the kind of music they'd swing to, kids, back in the day. And, of course, we were talking earlier about the rock and roll scene that happened at the Civic Center and the Parthenon, the Paramount, and all the other great venues. We'll talk a bit more about that in a bit. But my guest tonight is book author Joseph S. Pete. His book is Lost Hammond, Indiana, and it covers a gamut of wonderful history, lots of great photos as well. If you grew up in Northwest Indiana, not necessarily Hammond, but just Northwest Indiana, Hammond was the center point for so much back in the early days. Joseph, I remember, speaking of that era, I remember my mom and my sisters who were about 10 years older than me, and my mom and them would shop in downtown Hammond. And I've heard stories from neighbors where it was like they didn't go to Chicago. They went to Hammond. They had Goldblatts and they had streetcars and they had buses, and it was a bustling city. And now you go down there and it's been destitute for the last couple of decades. Now, talking to our mutual friend Karen Marvella. She's telling me about all the great plans that are happening to revitalize downtown, and I certainly hope it works. But let's go back to the glory days of Hammond. What most surprised you about how bustling and how important Hammond was as a hub of the urban scene back then?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it was back during the days where most people shopped downtown. They had the grand downtown department stores. The two hubs in Northwest Indiana were, of course, Hammond and Gary, where people went to shop before mm-hmm. they had the South Lake Woodmar or the South Lake Mall or River Oaks or any of those. And it was, the downtown Hammond was just absolutely vibrant, bustling place that was filled with, grand department stores. There was Gold Blast, of course, and EC Minus are probably the two most prominent. There's a great historic photo I found that's on the back of the book where there's literally a line wrapped all the way down the street to get into the Gold Blast. I don't know it wasn't dated or anything. I don't know the occasion if it was, but that was, of course, the famous, the department store that famously inspired Gene Shepard in The Christmas Story, where, you know, all those department store scenes with Santa, that was from his childhood growing up there.
Mm-hmm.
And EC Minus was another that was a local institution. One thing I found that was really interesting that I discovered, I'm a big fan of the South Shore Arts, and I just think they do wonderful. The galleries in Hammond and Crown Point and, of course, Munster. And they put on some wonderful cultural programming that, with the eye on the arts, with Lakeshore Public Media as well, is wonderful, production values higher than anything you could see on, like, WTTW even. But they have that famous bowler hat logo where it's the black bowler hat. And I never really put any real thought into it, but I discovered in the course of researching this book that it was inspired by, because there used to be art salon shows where, like, a lot of the local artists would go and they'd exhibit their work in, like, department stores. And they would do it in, I think, in, like, Marshall Field in downtown Chicago initially held the Northwest Indiana one. But for some reason, they decided to discontinue it, and they're casting around to find somewhere to do it. And they settled on EC Minus in Hammond. And then it was held in and sponsored by the hat department there. And then, so the logo that remains to this day in use by the South Shore Arts League was inspired by the hat department at the EC Minus department store. But they were just big social centers. It wasn't just where people went to shop. People would, eat in the cafeterias. It was kind of the place to go out and to see and to be seen. It was, they had, streetcars and, like, jitneys, where it was basically almost like a short little taxi that would take you a couple blocks, but it was just you had a lot of, like, foot traffic, and it was just a bustling kind of center of commerce.
I didn't realize some of the stuff, like I said, that you have talked about in this book. I remember hearing the stories. I remember hearing about how people would line up and how, no matter what day you went down there, especially on Sundays and Saturdays, you'd be waiting in lines to get food, and everything was very ornate. Of course, we had the theaters down here, not one, not two, but like five theaters in Hammond. When did that all change? Was it the advent of the shopping malls, the River Oaks, the Woodmar, and eventually South Lake that put the nail in the coffin for Gary and for Hammond?
It was part of a national trend. It wasn't unique to our area. It was, just generally as the post-war era after World War II in the 50s, that interstate system kind of came in, and suburbanization kind of just started taking place, and people started moving away from crowded cities and more out into the suburbs. And then, but it was, Woodmar, the two of the biggest game changers, though, for that downtown was when they built Woodmar, which was one of the first shopping malls. It was designed by the Austrian architect, Victor Grün, I believe his name was. Hmm. He was, he designed, like, malls all over the country in, like, New Jersey and Georgia and Texas, and he was one of the first designers of it. And Woodmar was actually one of his earlier ones, which is why, like, some of the hallways originally, like, went, just led to kind of a dead end and that type of thing. Like, they hadn't worked through all the logistics of it initially. But he grew over the course of his life to kind of hate his creation for how it kind of changed society. And, he said before his death that he hoped all the shopping malls would be, eventually torn down. But it was, people started just shopping. It was more convenient. It was just the preferred option. People started shopping at the newer places, like Woodmar and River Oaks was obviously huge back in the day, and mm-hmm. that just drew people away. And then, one by one, the department stores started closing and the movie theater started closing. And then it was, you'd had signs out like, please support your local businesses. And then, but for all of the hustle and bustle that was once downtown, it did have some disadvantages working against it. Like the trains were always a big issue. It was easier to get to like Woodmar or River Oaks, and it was just it's the malls now themselves are dying, and it's right. The societal changes that you see. But it's the one thing though is there is still a lot of life downtown Hammond. It's not, you know, it's not what it was. It's not like a giant center of commerce, but it's, you know, they still have the Hammond Baptist Church draws a lot of people. You have some good cultural amenities. It's just Serendipity is there. They have the Toll Theater.
Right.
Puts on good production. Drew Fox has built this miniature, like, artisan spirits empire there, where he's got the 18th Street Brewery, which was named, like, best brew pub in the country by USA Today. They have the 18th Street Distillery and then the Sour Note Brewing. And you see efforts like that where they're trying to, bring people back and you have some cultural activities, you have the arts festivals and the Beatles festival. It's not entirely like a ghost town.
Right.
There is still some,
it was about 15 years ago. It started to become a ghost town, and I am seeing it resurge a little bit here and there. And like I said, I know Karen and some of the different people downtown are pushing hard to get it revitalized. All revitalized Hammond. They brought in some special architects and designers and things from someone who has studied the past, and we always learn from our past to have a future. What is your personal thoughts? Do you think Hammond can come back in close to the same way it used to be, now that we're seeing the malls shutting down and we're seeing more focus on community? I mean, we see on a smaller scale Valparaiso and Crown Point, how people are going back to their local squares or local cities, and we're seeing a burgeoning scene developing. Hammond was huge. Do you think we'll get it huge again?
Well, I think it still could be a vibrant, center of activity, but I mean, it'll just look different than it was before, because like the moving hand rights and having moves on, or, moving hand rights and having grit moves on, and no one can change a word of it. And it's like, just the times have changed, and, the department stores won't come back. It's unlikely, like suburban movie theaters, the multiplexes that displaced the original grand movie palaces like you used to have in downtown Hammond. They themselves are now like falling out of fashion,
mm-hmm.
but there is opportunity when there's, when things do get to kind of like a low point in a ghost town, then there's opportunity for, creative people to come in and do interesting things that, they might not have otherwise been able to do. And I think it could still be a hub and a center. It's just people might not go there to shop there. They might go there to see a play or sip a craft beer, or, go to art gallery exhibit or something of that nature. But it could definitely be, the city is working on that big redevelopment plan where they brought in this urban planner, and they're looking at kind of piggybacking a little bit off the South Shoreline development and trying to bring in new, and that's not new. My book kind of goes over that. There have been various redevelopment efforts over the years, like they've tried to turn various historic buildings into like luxury apartments and that type of thing, and those efforts didn't necessarily pan out. But it can still be like a vibrant center of life. It's just maybe on a different scale and kind of different activities.
Mm-hmm.
But people like the millennial generation has kind of been returning to cities, and you're maybe not seeing that. You're maybe seeing that more with like larger cities where there's like a vibrant nightlife and that type of thing. But like, and then not as much as with smaller cities, but it's still like, it could still very well be, a big, community hub. But like you have wonderful stuff there. Like the Paul Galleries, Paul Henry's Art Gallery has wonderful, like, open mic nights.
Mm-hmm.
They have wonderful, they have a lot of like punk shows there. They have showcase artists from all throughout the area. They have like, all kinds of readings and authors and an old like 19th century hardware store. So that's like that's possibly like a model for what could be done. Like you can kind of preserve the past while repurposing it for something new to kind of
right.
Adjust to the times, I guess.
And I like what they've done with the old Woolworths, which of course is now Eat. I've produced a couple concerts there, and that's in that same hub next to Paul Henry's Art Gallery, and we're seeing that develop. So I think if enough people got involved and took the lead, like these two businesses we just mentioned have, we could see that turn. And of course, the Toll Theater's down there, and I understand the South Shore, is it going to be running? They're putting in new stops there?
Oh, yes. I'm not sure that they've settled on the I'm not the person to ask about this, unfortunately, but I know the stop is going to be, when they do the extension, one of the stops is supposed to be near downtown, I believe. And they were hoping to kind of the Michigan City and Miller and Gary are kind of doing the same thing where they're hoping to kind of develop around it and then have the, you know, the thought that you can go, you know, you could basically live near the train station and commute to work in Chicago and then come back and hoping to see some development from that. I'm not sure about the exact location it's supposed to go, but I'm pretty sure there was one that's near the downtown that they're looking to kind of build upon.
You know, we were talking about the theaters, and I'd love to see some of the theaters come back. I was there and attended shows, both concerts and films, at the Paramount and the Parthenon, of course, the Kennedy Rock and Chair Theater before it was redeveloped. Paramount was one I'd almost forgotten about because Parthenon seems to get all the memories because more bands played there. But your book reminded me of the fact that Dave Clark Five played there in 1965. And I just find that fascinating. I became friends later in life with Mike Smith, the lead singer of the Dave Clark Five. And his widow is a good friend of mine. And we still talk all the time. And so we're going to play a song. They were there. According to your book, they were there to promote Catch Us If You Can, which was their big movie. It was kind of a takeoff on what the Beatles were doing. And if I understand correctly, they showed the movie and then the band was there as well to promote it?
Yes, that was, yes, and I believe they got a huge reception. There were a lot of young ladies that it turned out that were very interested in seeing them, and it was, I believe it was completely sold out, but they had to turn away more than 600 people who showed up for the, and it was one of those where it was, you know, frantically screaming, mostly female fans. I think it was described in the news article I pulled up. But yeah, they actually had quite a few. But they were, I think they did more live entertainment earlier in the century because they also had like Bob Hope and Bing Crosby and Benny Goodman. And, you know, I think they were maybe more active a little bit like in the first half of the 20th century with that. But they
So maybe Paramount kind of inspired the Parthenon to turn that direction too, perhaps.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Okay. Well, let's play the title track of that film that brought them here in 1965. Here is the band that was on Ed Sullivan more than anyone, including the Beatles, the Dave Clark Five, one of the top three most popular best-selling bands of the British invasion. Here we go.
Here they come again. Catch us if you can. Time to get a move on. We were young with all of our might. Catch us if you can, catch us if you can, catch us if you can, catch us if you can. Now we gotta run, no more time for fun. When we're getting angry, we were young with all of our might. Catch us if you can.
Taking you back to the mop top days of the 1960s British invasion when the Dave Clark Five came to Hammond, Indiana, and rocked us at the Paramount Theater as they were showing their film, Catch Us If You Can, which is kind of their version of Help and Hard Day's Night, and all the British bands were getting into that at the time. And my guest today, as we reflect on Lost Hammond, is the author of Lost Hammond, Indiana, Joseph S. Pete. He's also a business journalist with the Times newspaper. You mentioned, Joseph, that you always wanted to write a book. Now that you've done that, is it out of your desire, or has it inspired that you want to do more books?
Oh, no, I'm definitely doing more. I, in fact, have another one coming out this fall by Reedy Press out of St. Louis. It's called 100 Things to Do in Gary, Northwest Indiana Before You Die. It's also kind of part of a local interest series. And they are, it's focusing on, you know, different, you know, like the obvious things like the Indiana Jones National Park and Three Floyds Dark Lord Day. And but it's focusing on, you know, kind of bucket list items for Northwest Indiana mm-hmm. and various things you should try to see and do, like the Bison Farm by Hobart and so on, tour of Marktown and New Chicago. And, you know, things of that nature. But that's already turned in, and it's going into production soon, and that's actually coming out later this year. It's just been an interesting experience where it's kind of been my lifelong dream to do a book. And then, of course, it happens during the pandemic where, you know, all the readings I was supposed to do have obviously been, like, canceled. I can't even go to the Hammond Historical Society until next year. I'm tentatively scheduled to do a reading at Miles Books in Highland at May 30th at 11:30 to 3, I believe. A signing. And then he's already got multiple signed copies. He's been selling it throughout this whole thing. But it's, you know, a lot of the bookstores have been closed, and it's right. just difficult. And then, but they take orders by phone, and it's 219-838-8700. And they've been a good supporter throughout this whole thing. And that's another bookstore I used to go to when I was growing up.
Yeah, Miles has moved around a little bit downtown Highland there. Right now he's currently on Jewett Street, right next to SIP, if I remember.
Oh, absolutely.
The coffee house.
Oh, yeah, right there. And But I'm also planning on writing more books. I want to go into novels. I write for a lot of literary journals, too, in addition to the Times. I write, like, poetry and humor and short stories and that type of thing, and eventually I want to kind of graduate to writing novels. And I have a couple, like, I've got a multi-generational one. I kind of want to write about Northwest Indiana, kind of how it has changed, you know, over the times. This kind of industry has shifted and that type of thing. So I'm just going to keep, you know, working on bigger and bigger book projects.
Mm-hmm. So that one is coming out later this year. Is that's not through History Press, though? That was for a different publisher?
Yes, it's Reedy Press out of St. Louis. And they do a series, too, where it's like 100 Things to Do in Chicago Before You Die, 100 Things to Do in Indianapolis and St. Louis and, you know, Toledo Before You Die. And then they I pitched them on doing one about Northwest Indiana, and they like the idea. And it encompasses the entire region, mostly Lake and Porter and LaPorte counties, but it also has some stuff like watching the sandhill cranes migrate at the Jasper Pulaski Wildlife Area and Fair Oaks Farms and things of that nature. So it casts a wide net, but it tries to point out some of the most kind of interesting things to do in the area.
It's great because we've got folks like yourself, Phil Potempa, Jerry Davich, all great journalists from the newspapers out here that are now turning their talents to books and historical pieces. And I think it is very important, as someone who has roots deep here, that we keep this alive. And I thank you on behalf of everyone here for keeping our history safe.
Oh, absolutely. And thanks everyone for reading this. But there are many great region history authors. Archibald McKinley was pretty good.
Oh, yes,
he passed away a couple of years ago. But Kenneth Shoon, he's been an excellent region historian. But for a lot of the older stuff, I had to cast back to kind of like Powell Moore's History of the Calumet Region and some, like, you know, much older books. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of local efforts to preserve and record the history here. It's just, I just always feel like in Northwest Indiana, we're kind of in the shadow or the orbit of Chicago, and we kind of get overlooked as, like, part of, you know, the bigger city that's right next door. And then we're not, like, we don't really fit in with the rest of Indiana. We kind of are kind of an outlier. We're like a no man's land between Chicago and Indiana, and we downstate Indiana, and we get, like, kind of overlooked.
Right.
So I'm just trying to tell the region stories and, you know, celebrate region greats like, you know, Gene Shepard and Terry Funk and, you know, the Hammond Pros. Hammond had an NFL team. Like, I never knew that as a kid growing up.
So I didn't know that either. That was an eye-opener in here. And you mentioned going to the boxing matches. I remember going to see Dick the Bruiser, the professional wrestling stuff, and the Roller Girls, the Roller Derby, you know, the Bombers and all these different groups as a young teen and a preteen going to some of that stuff. But one thing that you also point out here, and a lot of people may or may not realize, is that Hammond was a great place, and still is in many ways, if you think of places like El Taco Real, a great place for great restaurants. We had Vogel's. We had Phil Schmidt's, the best perch and frog legs in the world. You mentioned one of my places, too, that I grew up working in, and that's Miner Dunn. My mom started there in 1964 and worked there till just before her death. I worked there from the mid-70s, up until I went to college. So I did about 6-7 years there. And you talked about how they had different locations. And I was part of that expansion plan when they moved to Broadway and they had what's now Pepe's on US 30 in Schererville, when they were dabbling with not just the hamburgers, but also doing the silver dollar pancakes and things like that. So it was great to see that in here and see Mr. Ralph Dunn given credit. He was someone I got to know as a young man growing up. And Miner Dunn, God bless them, they're still there making those great mushroom burgers and hand dip fries and onion rings. And just some fun stuff that brings back a lot of memories. Did you mention, I didn't see it in here, the powwow?
Oh, no. I wish I did. There are a couple of places like Calumet Theater and a couple others that I was limited on the amount of words they gave
right.
me. It could only go up to. So unfortunately, there was there unfortunately ended up being like some omissions, but I don't think that one is in there.
Yeah, I didn't see that, and that's something for those that used to do the cruise back in the '60s and the '70s. You went to Blue Top in Highland, and you cruised all the way over to Powwow over in the Hessville Woodmar area there, and then back again. And you just make that circle all night long, and meet the girls, and see all the other cool cars. And that was a big deal. The Powwow was important, and there was fabulous hot dogs there too. That was part of that scene. An old Sinclair station turned into a hot dog, kosher hot dog stand. Excellent stuff. But I think we need a part two, my friend. I think we need a part two.
Well, that's exactly the kind of thing I wanted to have, but I wish I would have wrote it in like 400 pages if they would have let me. It's and I have toyed with the idea of doing a part two because there's a lot of, like, I wasn't able to touch upon like the schools and, mm-hmm. you know, the churches. And, you know, there are a lot of areas that I would have liked to explore more fully, but it's just with limitations of space, and you know, there's only so much you can do. But it's the Hammond and the rest of the region is ripe with history that, you know, just needs to be preserved and, you know, written down, you know.
Right. Well, you mentioned, actually, it's not mentioned, it's mentioned about you in the notes about the author, about how you are a big fan of Festival of the Lakes, and you remember when it was August Fest, and, you know, we just lost Little Richard, and I remember I was talking with some friends the other day about seeing Little Richard at August Fest when Mayor Tom Sr. was running it. All the great bands, Joan Jett, Steppenwolf, Little Richard, Gary Puckett, all these bands. I don't know if you're old enough to remember those. Those acts, did you catch any of those? Did you catch Little Richard?
No, I've only really started to go in the, I left the region for a while. I was in, like, the Army, and I ended up, but I came back to work for the Times, and I've been religiously attending Festival Lake since, I go at least a couple shows every year, since I got back in 2013. But, those are the main concerts I've been to there.
It's great that that Mayor Tom Jr. has continued that, because as we mentioned, the Paramount, the Parthenon, the Civic Center, all these great places, Hammond has a real history of live concerts, whether it was big band, rock, funk, whatever. And I think with Festival at the Lakes, he's continuing that heritage, which is a big part of what that city was about.
Oh, absolutely. And they're trying to do the bigger shows, too, at some of the separate shows that Wolf Lake Pavilion, like Snoop Dogg and that type of thing. But hopefully this coronavirus doesn't like derail that, and they're able to kind of start, you know, keep having some more of those shows like just outside of the Festival of the Lakes.
Right.
But it's really evolved into just a great, you know, music venue and good chance to see free, you know, free shows every year. They bring in a variety of acts for every talent. And yeah, it's just one of the, because that's the thing too with the book is Lost Hammond, but the way Northwest Indiana is it's kind of like, it's kind of like a balkanized city where you might live in an individual city or town, but you know, we're all kind of in it together. Mm-hmm. You know, you might have grown up in Dyer or something, but you probably still went to Festival of the Lakes. You know, we're all kind of pressed together. We might be in like separate little cities and towns or fiefdoms, but it's all kind of, you know, together into one bigger place. So a lot of this might be of interest, you know, whether you're from Valpo or Crown Point or you know, people remember the Woodmar Mall, or people want to reminisce about, you know, downtown or Phil Schmitz or any of those great institutions that were, you know, served generations of region residents.
Now, how can people find your book and keep up with you and what you're doing, Joseph? Is there a website or a Facebook page or some way they can follow what you're doing at this point?
Oh, I'm on Twitter. I'm most active, I guess, on Twitter at NWI _JSP. You can find me and friend me on Facebook. The book is available online. It's like Arcadia Publishing. It's at Arcadia Publishing or through Amazon, Barnes & Noble's, any of those ones. And it's also at local bookstores. Green Door Books by You, I believe, is going to have it when they reopen. And Miles Books in Highland, of course. And, okay. But it's you know, going to be available at local retailers whenever everyone gets back open. But, I mean, online, I'm most active on Twitter.
Okay. Well, we are out of time, but I'd love to have you come back when that next book comes out and talk some more. And hopefully we'll be able to get you in studio for that and not have to do it by phone so we can make a little eye contact. But it's been great having you, Joseph. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's been so great talking to you. Thank you.
All right. Lost Hammond, Indiana is the book. The author, Joseph S. Pete. Look for it. Why don't we do the Hounds Drugland Weekend, since that was the first band from the area that I got to MC at the Civic Center. So we'll close out with that. Your headline's coming up. Thank you, Jose. Thank you, Joseph S. Pete. And thank you for listening. Adios, everybody.